Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And we're providing you the content, and actually, it's really apropos that we're going through Hamilton's plan. We didn't really go through all of the different plans like we did this year. We covered it in, you know, probably differently in the past episodes, but I wanted to make sure we kind of watched the evolution and the pushback and so forth. And so we've got Sean back with us, and so welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
And so you missed some really good meat. And I will tell you, you probably want to go back through what we covered. But there's a couple of highlights that kind of really, as far as I'm concerned, it starts showing Hamilton's paradigm. And what's interesting is I don't think Madison was picking up on some of these signals. Because Madison was really open to, and as a matter of fact, I kind of mentioned this, because Madison was kind of writing this. So he was providing insight that he was picking up on this, because at the very, very beginning, he said that Mr. Hamilton had been hitherto silent on the business before the convention, partly out of respect to others whom superior ages and abilities, experiences, so forth, rendered him unwilling to bring forward ideas dissimilar to theirs. So in other words, and Madison, being a pretty open and objective person, was, you know, hey, let's bring all the ideas and put them on the table. That's a sign of somebody that's absolutely open and objective, because they want to make sure that there's not any idea that's not brought to the table, because the worst thing that can happen is you move forward, you settle on something, and somebody comes along with an idea that actually would make a better impact or make a huge improvement to what you've done. So he also goes on, and I'm just going to read some highlights, that he was obliged, therefore, to declare himself unfriendly to both plans. He was particularly opposed to that from New Jersey, being fully convinced that no amendment of the Confederation leaving the states in possession of their sovereignty could possibly answer the purpose. And on the other hand, he confessed he was much discouraged by the amazing extent of country in expecting the desired blessings from any general sovereignty that could be substituted. So in other words, he just said, well, you guys are going down the wrong path here. And then he kind of pointed out these different four or five different positions of where he just saw the real problems. And the number two position was, he was pointing out that the love of power, men love power. The same remarks are applicable to this principle. The states have consistently shown a disposition rather to reign the powers delegated by them than to part with more or to give effect to what they had parted with. The ambition of their demagogues is known to hate the control of a general government. It may be remarked, too, that the citizens have not the anxiety to prevent the dissolution of the general government as the particular government. So it's kind of showing this, you know, the designs or the cabals protecting themselves, as well as the fact that, you know, the people, you know, they're not displeased with the general government. And really the reason why is because it has had zero impact or effect on them, other than maybe Massachusetts, because the Shays rebelled, because the taxes that they owed. Now, a little bit further down, he's going and he gets into these histories, and he kind of creates this list of the Greek and German, and then he finally provides one other example about the Swiss cantons have scarce the Swiss cantons have scarce any union at all. In other words, the states aren't really united and have been more than once at war with another. How then are all these evils to be avoided only by such a complete sovereignty in the general government? In other words, he believes that the state should be wiped out completely. In other words, not trying to create a general sovereignty and splitting it with the states. He, you know, he's going down the path, and I'm just going to let the cat out of the bag. Hamilton had the mind that America needed to create its own monarchy. We're ready to kind of pick up, because he went through some other history and so forth. And so anyway, let's kind of go through, because he weaves back and forth between theory, history, and what he sees and why this is the, you know, why what he sees is the better way to go. So go ahead. Let's pick up with the different degrees of industry and on.
The different degrees of industry and improvement in different countries render the first object a precarious measure of wealth. Much depends, too, on situations. Connecticut, New Jersey, and North Carolina, not being commercial states and contributing to the wealth of the commercial ones, can never bear quotas assessed by the ordinary rules of proportion. They will and must fail in their duty. Their example will be followed, and the union itself will be dissolved. Whence, then, is the national revenue to be drawn? From commerce? Even from exports, which notwithstanding the common opinion are fit objects of moderate taxation, from excise, and et cetera, though not equal, are less unequal than quotas. Another destructive ingredient in the plan is that the quality of suffrage, which is so much desired by the small states. It is not in human nature that Virginia and the large states should consent to it, or if they did, that they should long abide by it. It shocks too much the ideas of justice and every human feeling. Bad principles in a government, though, slow, are sure in their operation and will gradually destroy it. A doubt has been raised whether Congress at present have a right to keep ships or troops in time of peace. He leans to the negative. Mr. P's plan provides no remedy. If the powers proposed were adequate, the organization of Congress is such that they could never be properly and effectually exercised. The members of Congress, being chosen by the states and subject to recall, represent all the local prejudices. Should the powers be found effectual, they will from time to time be heaped on them, till a tyrannic sway shall be established. The general powers, whatever be its form, if it preserves itself, must swallow up the state powers. Otherwise, it will be swallowed up by them. It is against all the principles of good government to vest the requisite powers in such a body as Congress. Two sovereignties cannot coexist within the same limits. Giving powers to Congress must eventuate in a bad government or in no government. The plan of New Jersey, therefore, will not do. What then is to be done?
Okay, so right here,
was embarrassed.
So right here, he's kind of poking everybody in the eye, and he's literally stating that we need to absolve the states and force everything into this monarch system or this general government system. He actually, I think, he starts exposing his plan that he thinks the executive needs to be for life and so forth, which doesn't point to a hereditary monarch, but a new framework. And, you know, out of the history of monarchies, it's always come down to either a theocratic monarchy or a heretic monarchy. In other words, hereditary, where, you know, it goes down these family lines. Now, in England, interestingly enough, because they had some monarchs that didn't have kids, that became problematic. And so this is why they started intermingling some of the lines of what they considered this, you know, the second tier royalty. Now remember, the land barons, before Britain really became independent, there were these land barons that kind of had this status. And they waved back and forth between these different monarchs, while in between being ruled by France and other nations that were kind of taking over, Rome and so forth. So as they finally start, they finally got to the point where they cast off France, and then in the 1600s, they literally cast off the world empire, right? The Spanish Armada, I think it was in 1590-something, 1602, is when I think Britain actually became the world empire. And so as we look at how this all migrated, because they had these problems with, you know, not wanting to get married and having children, the I think it was the Archbishop of Canterbury decided to look through the lines going down and find other lines, and then started, you know, trying to create a very like a hierarchical lineage of, well, if there's nothing in this particular line, then this next line will be, you know, the priority if we can find a king and or a queen and so forth. And this is why usually when the monarch dies, if there's not a natural hereditary heir, then the Archbishop of Canterbury starts looking at who could be, because it's not a slam dunk. And whether that person's there, whether that person's right, or what have you, because, you know, they want to make sure that they have the best. And this goes into where the function of the Archbishop of Canterbury really helps kind of support the strength of the crown, as well as supports the seeding of the hereditary line, because they didn't want it to go away. And you got to understand, who appoints the Archbishop of Canterbury?
The king.
There you go. So it's cyclic. So they both had this symbiotic relationship in kind of protecting their own lines, and or making sure that the next Archbishop of Canterbury was the guy that was going to maintain, you know, all, you know, he was in the circle of trust, was going to maintain this process and so forth, and not become a rebellion against it. And I mean, I have no idea what the heck's going on there now. But anyway, so okay, so it's clear, right? He's basically laying out that they need to get rid of the states at this point in time. How does Hamilton think this kind of plan could even succeed?
I don't think he does. I think he's putting out like points for them to ponder. And I mean, considering the how the states came together and started all of this, I think he was well aware that that was never going to go over.
Well, so
but that they had to find some way to find a compromise in a hybrid situation that maybe nobody's ever thought of before.
Okay, so there's in America at this point in time, when the Constitutional Convention was meeting, there were two fundamental factions of thought. There were the Anglophiles that, you know, believed in that form, because Anglophiles and Francophiles, they both were monarchies, but they both believed in, you know, kind of this liberty, the rights of people and so forth, which is why Britain had a Bill of Rights. And so there were probably more out of America, there were more that lent towards the Anglophile side than the French or the Francophile. But out of those, there was actually a lot of people that thought America needed to go to a king. And that's one of the reasons why Madison knew that he needed to get George Washington, because it was the closest thing to a king, to get to this Constitutional Convention. One, to give it credibility, and to, you know, make sure that everybody shows up, that everybody participates. Washington was key to the success, which is one of the reasons why it was his mission to make sure that Washington attended. And like I said, if you go through these bibliographies, or these biographies, I should say, not bibliography, these biographies of the framers, and with Madison, as he was struggling to get, you know, Washington to focus on something that was going to save America at that point in time, Washington's focus was really towards the Society of Cincinnati, and General Knox being involved in that. Madison basically sent a couple of letters saying, hey, can you please convince, you know, the good general to, you know, not worry about that, because we need him in May, because that's how it was set and cast in stone, that it was going to be in May for this convention, and it was going to be a conflict when the Society of Cincinnati was going to choose their next grand poobah, which is basically, it is an aristocracy type of society. And see, here's the problem that Washington going into that, you know, you understand the key point of an aristocracy, because it's very similar to a hereditary line, right? The aristocracy is based upon the fact that you have children. Does that make sense? Because your position gets handed down. I mean, they become, I guess in fraternity sense, they're legacies. They're guaranteed membership into this fraternity or into this society. And so the fact that Washington was trying to become the leader without a child, he never had a child. It's like, okay, we're just going to vote this person up. But, you know, he's just like this one bright flame that'll burn, and there will be no following lineage coming from that line of Washington. So anyway, it's kind of like, I don't want to say it is a paradox, but it's ironic that he was so fixated on this when he was offering no child, and he was so far in his age. You know, I think he died, 9, 10 years later, or maybe 12, 13 years later. But anyway, nevertheless, let me get back to this. The point is that Hamilton really had a consensus that there were a few people that would support this. But as you moved more towards the South, they wouldn't support this. And as a matter of fact, from Virginia down South, there were far more Francophiles than there were Anglophiles. Anglophiles and Francophiles, the one big difference was the Anglophile was pushing and migrating towards factories, industries, and those types of things, and, you know, kind of moving away from the agrarian lifestyle of growing your food and, you know, your meat, all that type of stuff, being ranchers. And so that's why there was an ideological, I'll say, debate between Jefferson and Hamilton, that America needed to bring in industry, and Jefferson felt, no, we need to be, you know, closer to the Lord. And, you know, people look at Jefferson as really not a spiritual man, but in most all of his principles and making sure that the land was for the living, and that, you know, that we would all be blessed by the land, and this concept that our soul is attached to our land, where Hamilton and Jefferson looked at the industries or factories as really more of slave bins, where people, you know, they don't have any property, they're just getting money, and so forth and so on. So, I mean, there's this real ideological conflict between the two of these guys. And so in some ways, Jefferson was right, but he ended up losing arguments because more and more people wanted to go with the factories, wanted to go with the Anglican side, so forth and so on. So that's one of the reasons why, as soon as the Constitution was ratified, the government started forming, Hamilton was able to find and help get these guys into office that wanted to have a big, powerful, centralized government and started moving the government in that direction. This guy was a political force that both Jefferson and Madison, I think, took for granted. But nevertheless, let's go back into the fact that he was embarrassed and on. So let's go with that. Thank you.
Here he was embarrassed. The extent of the country to be governed discouraged him. The expense of a general government was also formidable. Unless there was such a diminution of expense on the side of the state governments, as the case would admit. If they were extinguished, he was persuaded that great economy might be obtained by substituting a general government. He did not mean, however, to shock the public opinion by proposing such a measure. On the other hand, he saw no other necessity for declining it. They are not necessary for any of the great purposes of commerce, revenue, or agriculture. Subordinate authorities, he was aware, would be necessary. There must be district tribunals, corporations for local purposes. But cui bono, the vast and expensive apparatus now appertaining to the states? The only difficulty of a serious nature which occurred to him was that of drawing representatives from the extremes to the center of the community. What inducements can be offered that will suffice? The moderate wages for the first branch would only be a bait to the little demagogues. $3 or thereabouts, he supposed, would be the utmost. The Senate, he feared, from a similar cause, would be filled by a certain undertakers who wished for particular offices under the government. This view of the subject almost led him to despair that a Republican government could be established over so great an extent. He was sensible at the same time that it would be unwise to propose one of any other form. In his private opinion, he had no scruple in declaring, supported as he was by the opinions of so many of the wise and good, that the British government was the best in the world, and that he doubted much whether anything short of it would do in America. He hoped gentlemen of different opinions would bear with him in this, and begged them to recollect the change of opinion on this subject which had taken place and was still going on. It was once thought that the power of Congress was amply sufficient to secure the end of their institution. The error was now seen by everyone. The members most tenacious of republicanism, he observed, were as loud as any in declaiming against the vices of democracy. This progress of the public mind led him to anticipate the time when others as well as himself would join in the praise bestowed by Mr. Necker on the British Constitution, namely that it is the only government in the world which unites public strength with individual security. In every community where industry is encouraged, there will be a division of it into the few and the many. Hence, separate interests will arise. There will be debtors and creditors, etc. Give all power to the many, they will oppress the few. Give all power to the few, they will oppress the many. Both, therefore, ought to have power that each may defend itself against the other. To the want of this check, we owe our paper money, installment laws, etc. To the proper adjustment of it, the British owe the excellence of their Constitution. Their House of Lords is a most noble institution, having nothing to hope for by a change, and a sufficient interest by means of their property in being faithful to the national interest. They form a permanent barrier against every pernicious innovation, whether attempted on the part of the Crown or of the Commons. No temporary Senate will have firmness enough to answer the purpose. The Senate of Maryland, which seems to be so much appealed to, has not yet been sufficiently tried. Had the people been unanimous and eager in the late appeal to them on the subject of a paper emission, they would have yielded to the torrent. Their acquiescing in such an appeal is a proof of it. Gentlemen differ in their opinions concerning the necessary checks from the different estimates they form of the human passions. They suppose 7 years a sufficient period to give the Senate an adequate firmness, from not duly considering the amazing violence and turbulence of the democratic spirit. When a great object of government is pursued, which seizes the popular passions, they spread like wildfire and become irresistible. He appealed to the gentlemen from the New England states whether experience had not there verified the remark. As to the executive, it seemed to be admitted that no good one could be established on Republican principles. Was not this giving up the merits of the question? For can there be a good government without a good executive? The English model was the only good one on this subject. The hereditary interest of the king was so interwoven with that of the nation and his personal...
Okay, so one of the things that we're going to have to get back to where he kind of left off when the music came in. So what we'll do is we'll jump back a little bit. But unfortunately, all of this is so good, and this is a long read, folks. We'll probably end the show going into the content as well. But
All this being said, he's literally laying out his view. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so welcome back. And, Sean, obviously you kind of heard the reduction in sound in your ears that, we're going into a break. Okay, so I was really engrossed in what you were reading and, you know, finding key points and so forth. And so what I'd like to do to get us back onto where you were is to highlight something right before we kind of ran out of time. But before I do that, as one that's been reading this, what's your take so far of Hamilton standing up and addressing all of the delegates in this convention, you know, basically saying, you know, we're going down the wrong direction here. What's your thoughts on, you know, how he's presenting this and so forth?
Well, I mean, he's obviously, excuse me.
Yeah, it's okay. I have a dog too, and sometimes they bark. So I get it. Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's obvious that he sees that there's some division and some factions going on.
Right.
And he's trying to give them the points that are going to be the hard things for them to deal with.
Right. And so he kind of already talked about the history and so forth. And then he comes off and basically, you know, I think it's up here a little bit where he points out that, you know, the English government is, you know, hands down the best government ever. And, you know, everybody, he basically says the praise bestowed by Mr. Necker on the British Constitution, right? And then he continually goes on and on. And then he starts talking about this idea of having checks and balances, that, you know, how the Commons and the House of Lords, along with the Crown, how, you know, the House of Lords is really the check between the two. But it really, I'm not convinced that it really worked that way, because ultimately when there was going to be action in America, the Crown made their own decision. The Crown decided we're gonna go and punish these guys. And in other words, King George was the one that basically says, we're going to war. I don't think Parliament was necessarily in favor of going to war, but I just think that that was the king's call. He basically says this, though, because he's talking about these checks. And this is kind of interesting, because when we think today of creating an organization or creating a government, now, not that everybody does this. I mean, people, we've been blessed not even having to think in these realms, right? I mean, we haven't been creating government, you know, for a century or two, other than maybe, you know, a city government or a town or something like that. Nine times out of ten, I don't believe that the prevailing concern in framing a government in all of these towns that have been created has been ensuring that there are checks and balances to ensure that the needs of the people and the good function of government don't get impeded. And so he kind of says this.
The gentlemen differ in their opinions concerning the necessary checks from the different estimates they form of the human passions. They suppose 7 years is a sufficient period to give the Senate an adequate firmness from not duly considering the amazing violence and turbulence of the democratic spirit. So these guys are obviously, because he's speaking in the same language, these guys were obviously very well aware of where they were and what they were doing and trying to frame, you know, creating a government that was self-cleaning kind of thing. You know, creating that perfect household appliance like the oven that had all of these safety features, all of these, you know, checks and balances and even self-cleaning. You know, because that's where their heads were. You know, when you look through history, the annals of history, how many times was there ever a point in time where a group of men sat down and said, we need to do this? And I can think of one, and that would be in 1215 when the 25 land barons sat down with King John and they framed the Magna Carta, where there was, I don't want to say there was tranquility, these men had to draw swords on King John. They had to force him to take them seriously and say, we're not putting up with this crap anymore. And so they got their results. They got Parliament created, and they made significant changes in the British government. The Constitutional Convention, folks, is literally, minus the drawing of swords and everything else, is literally the epitome of brilliant minds coming together and saying, we have an inept and impotent government. We need to change this or we're going to fall off the cliff. What we have is a union, and our, you know, those things that bind us together is basically washing away. We need to fix this now. And so instead of just going in and trying to come up with, you know, some other new spin on an old tried idea or creating a monarchy, these guys literally said, okay, you know, let's put everything on the table. Let's figure out what we need to do. And they were considering checks and balances. They had such, I don't think that there's any book out there. I'm not aware of any book that says, hey, if you're going to go off and create a government, you want to make the best government in the world, this is what you got to do. And so where did that come from? And it had to come from going over to the church every morning, getting on their knees and prostrating themselves, asking the creator to supplicate them so that they can actually create the system that he would bless. Where you kind of left off is right after that democratic spirit, that I think we can kind of pick it up from there and keep moving. I know that as I look at this, this is definitely a long read. And we've still got a long way to go. We probably got a few more pages to go. We might actually get it done today. But what is important, and actually I don't think you know this, and I'll say this now. By this point in time, I believe the other two delegates from New York had kind of left. Lansing and I forget the other gentleman's name. Actually, Lansing, I think, leaves a little bit later. Eventually there gets to a point where there are no delegates from New York. Hamilton leaves shortly after this. As a matter of fact, I think when he was done in this oration, he kind of walked out, and I don't believe he actually came back for any meaningful point or offering. He basically ended up going back up to New York. And this is when he started spending time on getting, I'm trying to remember, it wasn't Yeats. I'm trying to remember who it was that was up there. It may have been Yeats, to write a letter to George Washington down in the convention speaking of the importance of natural-born citizen. And so when you look at the history of what Hamilton had done throughout his life, he was constantly meddling and manipulating. And so when he went back to New York, that's exactly what he was doing, meddling and manipulating. And so anyway, I digress. So let's go ahead and pick it back up, like I said, with when a great object of government is pursued at that point, right there. Thanks.
Okay, I got it. Object of government is pursued, which seizes the popular passions, they spread like wildfire and become irresistible. He appealed to the gentleman from the New England states, where their experience had not there verified the remark. As to the executive, it seemed to be admitted that no good one could be established on Republican principles. Was not this giving up the merits of the question, for can there be a good government without a good executive? The English motto was the only good one on this subject. The hereditary interest of the king was so interwoven with that of the nation, and his personal emolument so great that he was placed above the danger of being corrupted from abroad, and at the same time was both sufficiently independent and sufficiently controlled to answer the purpose of the institution at home. One of the weak sides of republics was their being liable to foreign influence and corruption. Men of little character acquiring great power become easily the tools of intermeddling neighbors. Sweden was a striking instance. The French and English had each their parties during the late revolution, which was affected by the predominant influence of the former. What is the inference from all these observations? That we ought to go as far in order to attain stability and permanency as Republican principles will admit. Let one branch of the legislature hold their places for life, or at least during good behavior.
Okay, so right here, he created his view of the executive, and he clearly stated, correct me if I'm wrong, the only kind of executive that we can successfully have in this republic would be a hereditary monarch.
I don't think he was suggesting that. I mean, I don't know enough about it to really make a academic.
Okay, so let me just reread what you
whatever,
read.
But
it's okay. Let
that's
me read.
What I was going to say, I think he's pointing out things that work and then expounding on the downfalls of them.
Okay, so as to the executive, it seemed to be admitted that no good one could be established on Republican principles. Was it not given up the merits of the question, for can there be a good government without a good executive? The English model was the only good one on this subject. The hereditary interest of the king was so interwoven with that of the nation, and his personal emolument so great, that he was placed above the danger of being corrupted from abroad, and at the same time was both sufficiently independent and sufficiently controlled. I don't know about you, but to me, he's really selling this British monarchical executive theme. It seems like that's his endorsement, because he starts it off with, the English model was the only good one. Because you got to remember, Britain was a republic. They were a monarchical, theocratic republic, where they had all these different states. As a matter of fact, what they had was a commonwealth. Instead of calling it a union, they had a commonwealth. Virginia was a colony in the Commonwealth, and Virginia maintained the name Commonwealth as a part of the Union, and many of the old colonies did. Canada being a Commonwealth of Britain, Australia being a Commonwealth of Britain, so on and so forth. So when we look at, and they still pay taxes, or I should say, they still pay tribute to the monarch. Canada still pays a tribute to the monarch, which is why their taxes are so high. But anyway, all I'm saying is he's really framing, as I see this, you know, when you look at somebody trying to sell something, when they try to say these types of words, like this is the only good thing, or this, it's really creating, you know, how can we think anything else would do? At least that's how I see this. But anyway. And then he...
No, I get it. I get what you're saying. Okay. Yeah. And I think he had ulterior motives. I really do.
Yeah.
I mean, judging from all the things that I've learned from working with you and doing research on the subject, it seems that he was that infiltrator that was trying to get the government to go a certain way to, so that it can be compromised.
Right. And you
like
know,
leaving little back doors everywhere.
And, you know, it's one thing to stand up and argue strictly on the merits of academic support, and supporting your arguments with evidence and empirical data, blah, blah, blah. It's one thing to be a person of principle, to literally do that. But Hamilton didn't do that. Hamilton actually, he let everybody know what he was doing, and then they decided to go a different way. And instead of going that way, he did everything he could to undermine every little thing. As soon as he got into the Department of Treasury, he literally reached in. I don't know if you knew this, but while George Washington was building his, his executive branch, he appointed both Hamilton, Knox, and Jefferson. Jefferson was just coming back from France as the emissary or the ambassador, and so he was getting settled in Monticello when he finally accepted his appointment to become the Secretary of State. Well, instead of letting Jefferson come in and create the roles, responsibilities of the Secretary of State, Hamilton was looking and going, hey, we need to divide these roles, responsibilities that are underneath this Constitution between these different branches. Okay, there's the War Department over here. I have the Department of Treasury, and he's going to have that. So he actually started carving out things that probably should have been under the Department of State. And so by the time Jefferson comes in and he looks at, what his roles and responsibilities are, he's looking over at Hamilton and going, how come you're doing those things? I should be doing those things. That should be a function of the Secretary of State. Well, you snooze, you lose, buddy. And at this point, Jefferson tried to pitch he pitched an argument against it. And Washington just basically, because he loved Hamilton, he considered him as like a son, he said, I think that, the way things are, it's going to work. It'll work fine. Just deal with it as you got it. Which instantly, that right there, walking in and having that little buzzsaw hit him, clipped his toenails, what have you. He was not happy, and he already looked at this guy as a conniving, control freak, what have you, narcissist, whatever. So, but nevertheless, the whole point is that was one thing that he did. He created an advantage for his department. And then, as he did that, he started arguing in Congress on basically principles that directly violated the way the Constitution was sold during the time of ratification. That there are powers within the Constitution, and then based on those powers, we can imply other powers. When the Constitution was strictly, strictly justified and ratified on the concept that only these powers are exercisable, that they can't do anything other than a direct derivative of that power. And now Hamilton's come along and say, well, it doesn't say a bank, but we're going to create one because we need one. And he redefined the necessary and proper clause. So my point is that he did everything to get to a certain point, to get the Constitution ratified, then, okay, now I'm going to start meddling with it and basically punching holes in it and ripping through it, because I'm not going to let this Constitution keep me from successfully moving this nation where I want it to go. That is how maniacal that man was, because there was really, I don't know of anybody else that was driving such an agenda to basically undermine the Constitution, or other than the fact that Jefferson and Madison were the two guys that were stopping him and saying, no, 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 you can't do that. You've got to get an amendment to be able to bring, to create a bank. You got to have an amendment to do these things. And Hamilton was just, as long as they get Congress to pass these things, then what are you going to do about it? Hamilton was one of those guys. As a matter of fact, we haven't even hit it yet, but we're going to, once we get through the ratification base, I'm going to go through some of the congressional debates and what ended up happening and how Hamilton literally got caught. And the tragic thing about the way they set the system up was they left it to a democracy to make the judge of things. And so
this goes down the idea that, you know, when something is identified as outside the Constitution, it's not about whether we want to punish the guy or not. The Constitution was violated. If you can't prove otherwise, then the guy should suffer the consequences of being removed. The problem is they didn't have the teeth at that point in time. But anyway, I digress. So let's go back up to the executive, because that's the next line. Let the executive also be for life.
Go ahead. Let the executive also be for life. He appealed to the feelings of the members present whether a term of 7 years would induce the sacrifices of private affairs which an acceptance of public trust would require, so as to ensure the services of the best citizens, On this plan, we should have in the Senate a permanent will, a weighty interest, which would answer essential purposes. But is this a Republican government, it will be asked. Yes, if all the magistrates are appointed and vacancies are filled by the people or a process of election originating with the people. He was sensible that an executive constituted, as he proposed, would have in fact but little of the power and independence that might be necessary. On the other plan of appointing him for 7 years, he thought the executive ought to have but little power. He would be ambitious with the means of making creatures, and as the object of his ambition would be to prolong his power. It is probable that in the case of war, he would avail himself of the emergence to evade or refuse a degradation from his place. An executive for life has not this motive for forgetting his fidelity, and will therefore be a safer depository of power. It will be objected, probably, that such an executive will be an elected monarch and will give birth to the tumults which characterize that form of power. If this executive magistrate would be a monarch for the life, the other proposed by the report from the Committee of the Whole would be a monarch for 7 years. The circumstance of being elective was also applicable to both. It had been observed by judicious writers that elective monarchies would be the best if they could be guarded against the tumults excited by the ambition and intrigues of competitors. He was not sure that the tumults were an inseparable evil. He rather thought this character of elective monarchies had been taken rather from particular cases than from general principles. The election of Roman emperor was made by the army. In Poland, the election is made by the great rival princes with independent power and ample means of raising commotions. In the German Empire, the appointment is made by the electors and princes, who have equal motives and means for exciting cabals and parties. Might not such a mode of election be devised among ourselves as will defend the community against these effects in any dangerous degree? Having made these observations, he read to the committee a sketch of a plan which should he prefer to either of those under consideration. He was aware that it went beyond the ideas of most members, but would such a plan be adopted out of doors? In return, he would ask, will the people adopt the other plan? At present, they will adopt neither, but he sees the union dissolving or already dissolved. He sees evils operating in the states which must soon cure the people of their fondness for democracies. He sees that a great progress has already been made and is still going on in the public mind. He thinks, therefore, that the people will in time be unshackled from their prejudices, and whenever that happens, they will themselves not be satisfied as stopping where the plan of Mr. R. would place them, but be ready to go as far, at least, as he proposes. He did not mean to offer the paper he had sketched of the proposition to the committee. It was meant only to give a more correct view of his ideas and suggest that the amendments which he should probably propose to the plan of Mr. R. in the proper stages of his future discussion.
Okay, so at this point, right, I mean, as if you look at everything you've read, how much did he go into the legislative branch? I mean, he talked a little bit about like the Senate or the House of Commons and Lords. And even though this is the beginning phase, he didn't dive too much in
necessarily the importance of the people legislating in by their representatives. So what I'm saying is, when you look at the voluminous oration of out of the three branches that ended up coming out of the Constitutional Convention and out what was proposed by Madison or Governor Randolph, his focus, or seems like the majority of everything he was pushing, was the executive so far. I mean, he hadn't talked about the judiciary yet, right? Okay. And so as we, you know, kind of understand, you know, where the focus is, it, to me, it helps us find where, you know, where Hamilton really is trying to galvanize a very specific outcome. And to me, that outcome was he wanted to change any idea of creating an elective executive and moving more towards a hereditary form of monarchy. So right, wrong, or indifferent, Hamilton was going to say what he wanted to say. And I think it started off interesting because we're reading this as Madison is capturing it. In other words, he's interpreting, he's not really writing word for word, but he's coming close to the things he's saying, the points he's making. But there's still the filter of the author or the writer, the you know, the scribe's pen and mind, because he starts off with how Hamilton came across with this humility that he felt that he was, you know, amongst giants, right? But he had no problem telling the giants how wrong they were. I mean, he expressed, going back to the very beginning, he expressed, what was it up here? He said, he was unwilling to bring forward ideas dissimilar to theirs. But he was obliged, therefore, to declare himself unfriendly to both plans. So in other words, he starts off saying, you know, I really don't want to do this, but now, you know, I'm letting the 800-pound gorilla out of me, and I'm going to just go rip you guys both plans apart and come at you with this, and we need to do that, and blah, blah. So anyway, to me, it lent more towards this idea of getting or retaining that form of executive. The focus was really ensuring that we had a hardcore monarchical or hereditary executive. We kind of ran out of time, so let's do a go back so that you can kind of comment, because you've been reading, and there's no doubt you garner on what you're reading, and I'd like to get, you know, your sentiments on some of the points that he was making, because, I mean, he's putting out a strong argument as to why this new government needed to have an executive in this form, a hereditary kind of monarch. So anyway, folks, we'll be back tomorrow. But before we dive in, we'll do a go back with Sean on some of the stuff he's kind of covered already. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.